Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Taiwan often talks about a median line when its military meets up with Chinese fighter jets in airspace between the island and China's mainland. Experts say the two sides have never agreed on the median line, so China believes it can cross it without violating any agreement. The line runs from an area near Japan's southern islands to the southwest, near Hong Kong, through the middle of the Taiwan Strait. A Taiwan Ministry of National Defense employee, who did not want to be named, said this week that it has just one definition. That definition is found in a 2019 report by the government-supported Central News Agency. A former defense minister detailed the line's exact position coordinates during a legislative hearing in 2004, the report said. Yet a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said in September that the median line does not exist. Experts in Taiwan say the line was established with the help of the United States during the Cold War, when Western countries competed against the Soviet Union and its allies. However, the median line never reached the level of an official agreement. It's not to say that some previous deal is being violated against Taiwan, because actually no third party was ever in the middle, nor did any two parties sign a legally binding agreement, said Huang Chengting. Huang is a researcher with the Institute for National Defense and Security Research in Taipei. It's just an understanding based on politics, Huang said. The median line is in place to help Taiwan and the mainland avoid mistakes. But it has become a point of disagreement this year as Chinese warplanes repeatedly cross it, causing Taiwan to scramble planes to meet them. As of October 7th, Chinese military aircraft had flown 49 times across the line in 2020. That is the highest number in any year since 1990. Median line crossings add to a growing list of problems between Taiwan and mainland China. The mainland has taken economic actions against Taiwan and pressured Taiwan's few diplomatic allies to recognize Beijing as the capital instead of Taipei. China claims sovereignty over Taiwan and states that the two sides should unite in the future. The sides split in 1949, when the Chinese Communist Party took control of the mainland and Chinese nationalist forces moved to Taiwan. Taiwan is self-ruled, and President Tsai Ing-wen rejects China's call for talks based on the idea that both sides belong to one country. The U.S. government has increased support for Taiwan this year. That support included arms sales, which have angered China. The U.S. government says it is required by a 1979 law to consider helping Taiwan's military if the island is attacked. Median line crossings still put Chinese aircraft at least 80 kilometers from Taiwan's coast. But China has never suspended the threat of force, if needed, to make the two sides unify. China's warplane activity in 2020 has caused some in Taiwan to wonder whether China is preparing to attack. Observers note that China honors the line that splits the 160-kilometer-wide Taiwan Strait when it has good relations with Taiwan's leadership. But the Chinese government believes its planes can cross the line when relations get worse. It's a line for many meanings. One is for some kind of goodwill between Taiwan and mainland, said Alexander Huang, a professor at Tom Kong University in Taiwan. When there is a relatively calm situation, then both sides try not to infringe upon or cross the line. The median line is unrelated to either side's civilian airspace. Those territorial borders extend 22 kilometers from the coast. Taiwan also enforces an air defense identification zone. It was established as an additional protection against Chinese warplanes, noted Huang Chengting. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
The development and testing of self-driving car technology has seen major progress in recent years. But engineers are working on other kinds of autonomous vehicles too, including some built for water. Researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, are leading one such project. The engineers have been developing autonomous water vehicles they call rowboats. The word is a combination of robot and boat. The project, which began in 2016, aims to create a group of boats to transport goods and people along the waterways of Amsterdam. The Dutch capital has been called the world's most watery city because of its large network of canals. The project was launched in an effort to explore how autonomous boats can make Amsterdam and other cities more efficient and improve the population's quality of life. MIT's Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, CSAIL, is leading the development in a partnership with the university's Sensible City Lab. The engineers centered past efforts on autonomous boats designed to transport small goods. But the project's latest creation, the rowboat, too, can also carry passengers. The developers used machine learning methods similar to those used to train self-driving cars. The robotic boats are designed to not only carry people and goods, but also connect with other rowboats to form a range of autonomous platforms, Daniela Rus said in a statement. She is a professor at MIT and the director of CSAIL. The electric-powered rowboat 2 has 4 propellers that permit it to move in any direction. It is equipped with a series of cameras and sensors to guide its movements. It also uses LIDAR, a technology that uses light lasers to map the environment and measure distances. The boats are designed to use the sensor-collected data to create and pilot a path between a series of goal points, the researchers say. The rowboat 2 measures 2 meters by 1 meter and weighs about 80 kilograms. A demonstration video of the model showed it carrying 2 passengers. The MIT team is currently developing its 3rd autonomous water vehicle. That boat is expected to be 4 meters long and is designed to carry up to 6 passengers. The researchers described their latest development and testing results in a paper published online. They said Rowboat 2 was successful in autonomously navigating the canals of Amsterdam for 3 hours while collecting data. The boat completed its chosen course and returned to the starting point with an error of just 0.17 meters, engineers reported. The team says it designed its autonomous system to involve separate boats working together. For example, Rowboat 2 vehicles can link up in larger groups guided by a leader boat, the researchers say. The follower boats can travel next to the leader boat, in front of it, or in back of it. This ability can greatly expand the possibilities of autonomous vehicles meant to transport goods. The MIT team plans to use what it has learned from its first 2 rowboats to create a model of its biggest autonomous boat yet. The researchers will test that boat in Amsterdam as well. After that, the team plans to start testing the vehicles in environments with more noisy waters, such as conditions found in the ocean. There have already been some experiments with autonomous shipping vehicles. In September, it was announced that an ocean research vehicle called the Mayflower Autonomous Ship would attempt to set sail across the Atlantic without a captain or crew on board. The 15-meter ship is a joint project of ocean research group Promare and IBM, the American computing company. It will take the same path across the Atlantic as the 1620 Mayflower, the ship that carried a group of European settlers to North America. The crossing is planned to begin early next year. The builders of the new Mayflower say they hope such ships can be used in the future to explore parts of oceans that are too difficult or dangerous for people to reach. I'm Brian Lynn.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. 1860 was a year of mixed feelings of hope and fear. Americans had hope for the future because they would be electing a new president. But they had fear that even a new president could not hold the nation together. The states of the South were very close to leaving the Union over the issue of slavery. Tony Riggs and Frank Oliver talk about the candidates and the issues in the election of 1860.
After 4 years as president, James Buchanan decided not to run again. Buchanan was a Democrat. His party, like the nation, was split over slavery. Southern Democrats wanted the party to support slavery. Northern Democrats refused. The opposition Republican Party expected to gain votes from dissatisfied Democrats. Republicans had become stronger since the last presidential election in 1856. They felt their candidate would win in 1860.
The Democratic nominating convention opened in April in Charleston, South Carolina. Senator Stephen Douglas of Illinois was the leading candidate. He had the support of a majority of convention delegates. But he did not have the two-thirds majority needed to win the nomination. Many Southern Democrats did not like Stephen Douglas. Some did not trust him. Others did not accept his policies on slavery. Douglas did not oppose slavery or the spread of slavery. However, he said no federal law could make slavery legal in a territory where the people did not want it. This was his policy of popular sovereignty.
The Southern Democrats who opposed Stephen Douglas were led by William Yancey of Alabama. Yancey wanted to get a pro-slavery statement into the party's platform. He was sure Douglas would not accept the nomination based on such a platform. If Yancey failed to get the statement he wanted, he would take Southern Democrats out of the convention and out of the party. The Committee on Resolutions considered three platforms. One platform declared that the people of a territory had the right to decide if slavery would be legal or illegal. The second declared that the Supreme Court had that right. And the third declared that no one did, that slavery was legal everywhere.
Your country, how came it yours? Before the pilgrims landed, we were here.
William Yancey spoke to the convention in support of the pro-slavery platform. He said pro-slavery Democrats did not want to destroy the Union. But he said someone had to make clear to anti-slavery Democrats that the Union would be dissolved if the constitutional rights of slave owners were not honored. Yancey spoke of the danger of a great slave rebellion. He described it as a sleeping volcano that threatened the lives, property, and honor of the people of the South. He said the actions of the North might cause that volcano to explode. Another convention delegate answered Yancey's speech. He said Northern Democrats were tired of defending the interests of the South. Now, he said, Yancey tells us we must agree that slavery is right. He orders us to hide our faces and eat dirt. Gentlemen of the South, he said, you mistake us. We will not do it.
In this atmosphere of tension, it was clear that a pro-slavery platform would not be approved. The Alabama delegation announced that, therefore, it must withdraw. The delegations from the other six states of the Deep South, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas, did the same. Those 50 men organized their own convention. They approved a pro-slavery platform, but did not nominate anyone for president. They agreed to meet again a few weeks later in Richmond, Virginia. The Northern Democrats postponed their nomination, too. They agreed to meet again in Baltimore, Maryland.
The Republican Party held its presidential nominating convention in Chicago, Illinois. There was no question who was the leading candidate. He was the best-known Republican in the country at that time, Senator William Seward of New York. The Republican platform seemed to contain something for everyone. For those opposed to slavery, the platform rejected the idea that slave owners had a constitutional right to take slaves into new territories. For foreign-born Americans, it supported their right to full citizenship. For manufacturers, it proposed a new tax on imports to protect American industry. And for those in the Northwest, it called for free land for settlers and federal aid to build roads and canals. Delegates approved the platform with loud cheers. They would return the next day to nominate their candidate for president.
William Seward was sure he would win the nomination. If not on the first vote, he thought, then on the second. But there was some opposition to Seward, and his campaign organization failed to see its strength. The candidate of the opposition was Abraham Lincoln. The Republican convention voted three times. Lincoln gained support on each ballot, but neither he nor Seward received enough votes for the nomination. Then, before a fourth vote could be taken, a delegate from Ohio asked to speak. The big room became silent. "Mr. Chairman," he said, "I rise to announce the change of four votes of Ohio to Mr. Lincoln." That was enough to give Abraham Lincoln the Republican nomination for president.
1 month later, the Democrats reopened their nominating convention. Most of the Southern Democrats who walked out of the first meeting came back. Many of their seats at the convention had been given to new delegates. So a new dispute arose over which delegates had the right to be there. A compromise plan split the seats between old and new delegates. But most of the Southerners rejected it. One by one, a majority of each Southern delegation walked out. The remaining Democrats then voted for a candidate. They chose Stephen Douglas. Southern Democrats nominated their own candidate, John Breckinridge of Kentucky, and a group called the Constitutional Union Party nominated John Bell.
The election campaign opened in the summer of 1860. Lincoln was not well known, so the Republican Party published many books and pamphlets about him. They told the story of a poor farm boy who educated himself and, through hard work and honesty, had become a candidate for president. Lincoln's supporters organized a loud and colorful campaign, complete with marching bands and signs. Lincoln himself was silent. He said, "It has been my decision since becoming a candidate to make no speeches. I am here only to see you and to let you see me." In fact, it was Lincoln's assistants who had advised him to say nothing. They believed he had said enough in the past to make clear his position on the important issues.
Stephen Douglas, on the other hand, campaigned very hard. His health was poor, and he had trouble getting money, but that did not stop him from speaking in almost every state. Within a few weeks, however, Douglas recognized that he had no real hope of winning. His position on slavery had cost him all support in the South. Douglas believed that, of the other candidates, Abraham Lincoln had the best chance of winning the presidential election. He also believed pro-slavery extremists would use Lincoln's election as an excuse to take Southern states out of the Union. So he turned his efforts to a campaign for the Union itself. He said, "The election of a man to the presidency by the American people, under the Constitution, is no reason for any attempt to dissolve this glorious nation."
Election day was November 6th. The popular vote was close between Lincoln and Douglas, but the electoral vote was not. Lincoln received 180. Breckinridge received 72. Bell received 39. And Douglas received just 12. Abraham Lincoln would be the new president of the United States. He would enter office facing the most serious crisis in American history. For before his inauguration, Southern states finally acted on their threats. They began to leave the Union.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.